a sophisticated literary tradition from their motherland. In 1736, booksellers advertised the availability of The Spectator, The Tatler, and Steele's Guardian. In 1738, advertisements appeared for Locke's Essay Concerning Human Understanding, Pope's Homer, Swift's A Tale of a Tub, and Dryden's Fables. Timothy Dwight, president of Yale University, described the American situation succinctly. Books of almost every kind on almost every subject are already written to our hands. Our situation in this respect is singular. As we speak the same language with the people of Great Britain and have always been at peace with that country, our commerce with it brings to us regularly not a small part of the books with which it is deluged. In every art, science, and path of literature, we obtain those which to a great extent supply our wants. One significant implication of this situation is that no literary aristocracy emerged in colonial America. Reading was not regarded as an elitist activity, and printed matter was spread evenly among all kinds of people. A thriving, classless reading culture developed because, as Daniel Boorstin writes, it was diffuse, its center was everywhere because it was nowhere. Every man was close to what printed matter talked about. Everyone could speak the same language. It was the product of a busy, mobile, public society. By 1772, Jacob Duché could write, "The poorest laborer upon the shore of the Delaware thinks himself entitled to deliver his sentiment in matters of religion or politics with as much freedom as the gentleman or scholar. Such is the prevailing taste for books of every kind that almost every man is a reader." Where such a keen taste for books prevailed among the general population, we need not be surprised that Thomas Paine's Common Sense, published on January 10, 1776, sold more than 100,000 copies by March of the same year. In 1985, a book would have to sell 8 million copies in 2 months to match the proportion of the population Paine's book attracted. If we go beyond March 1776, a more awesome set of figures is given by Howard Fast. No one knows just how many copies were actually printed. The most conservative sources place the figure at something over 300,000 copies. Others place it just under 500,000. Taking a figure of 400,000 in a population of 3 million, a book published today would have to sell 24 million copies to do as well. The only communication event that could produce such collective attention in today's America is the Super Bowl. It is worth pausing here for a moment to say something of Thomas Paine, for in an important way he is a measure of the high and wide level of literacy that existed in his time. In particular, I want to note that in spite of his lowly origins, no question has ever been raised, as it has with Shakespeare, about whether or not Paine was, in fact, the author of the works attributed to him. It is true that we know more of Paine's life than Shakespeare's, although not more of Paine's early periods, but it is also true that Paine had less formal schooling than Shakespeare and came from the lowest laboring class before he arrived in America. In spite of these disadvantages, Paine wrote political philosophy and polemics the equal in lucidity and vitality, although not quantity, of Voltaire's, Rousseau's, and contemporary English philosophers, including Edmund Burke. Yet no one asked the question, how could an unschooled staymaker from England's impoverished class produce such stunning prose? From time to time, Paine's lack of education was pointed out by his enemies, and he himself felt inferior because of this deficiency, but it was never doubted that such powers of written expression could originate from a common man. It is also worth mentioning that the full title of Paine's most widely read book is Common Sense, Written by an Englishman. The tagline is important here because, as noted earlier, Americans did not write many books in the colonial period, which Benjamin Franklin tried to explain by claiming that Americans were too busy doing other things. Perhaps so, but Americans were not too busy to make use of the printing press, even if not for books they themselves had written. The first printing press in America was established in 1638 as an adjunct of Harvard University, which was 2 years old at the time. Presses were established shortly thereafter in Boston and Philadelphia without resistance by the Crown, a curious fact, since at this time presses were not permitted in Liverpool and Birmingham, among other English cities. The earliest use of the press was for the printing of newsletters, mostly done on cheap paper. It may well be that the development of an American literature was retarded not by the industry of the people or the availability of English literature, but by the scarcity of quality paper. As late as Revolutionary days, George Washington was forced to write to his generals on unsightly scraps of paper, and his dispatches were not enclosed in envelopes, paper being too scarce for such use. Yet by the late 17th century, there was a beginning to a native literature that turned out to have as much to do with the typographic bias of American culture as books. I refer, of course, to the newspaper, at which Americans first tried their hand on September 25, 1690, in Boston, when Benjamin Harris printed the first edition of a 3-page paper he called Public Occurrences Both Foreign and Domestic. Before he came to America, Harris had played a role in exposing a non-existent conspiracy of Catholics to slaughter Protestants and burn London. His London newspaper, Domestic Intelligence, revealed the Popish plot, with the result that Catholics were harshly persecuted. Harris, no stranger to mendacity, indicated in his prospectus for Public Occurrences that a newspaper was necessary to combat the spirit of lying which then prevailed in Boston, and, I am told, still does. He concluded his prospectus with the following sentence: "It is supposed that none will dislike this proposal but such as intend to be guilty of so villainous a crime." Harris was right about who would dislike his proposal. The second issue of Public Occurrences never appeared. The governor and council suppressed it, complaining that Harris had printed reflections of a very high nature, by which they meant that they had no intention of admitting any impediments to whatever villainy they wished to pursue. Thus, in the New World began the struggle for freedom of information, which, in the Old, had begun a century before. Harris's abortive effort inspired other attempts at newspaper publication. For example, the Boston Newsletter, published in 1704, generally regarded as the first continuously published American newspaper. This was followed by the Boston Gazette in 1719 and the New England Courant in 1721, whose editor, James Franklin, was the older brother of Benjamin. By 1730, there were 7 newspapers published regularly in 4 colonies, and by 1800, there were more than 180. In 1770, the New York Gazette congratulated itself and other papers by writing, in part, "'Tis truth, with deference to the college, newspapers are the spring of knowledge, the general source throughout the nation of every modern conversation." At the end of the 18th century, the Reverend Samuel Miller boasted that the United States had more than 2/3 the number of newspapers available in England and yet had only half the population of England. In 1786, Benjamin Franklin observed that Americans were so busy reading newspapers and pamphlets that they scarcely had time for books. One book they apparently always had time for was Noah Webster's American Spelling Book, for it sold more than 24 million copies between 1783 and 1843. Franklin's reference to pamphlets ought not to go unnoticed. The proliferation of newspapers in all the colonies was accompanied by the rapid diffusion of pamphlets and broadsides. Alexis de Tocqueville took note of this fact in his Democracy in America, published in 1835. In America, he wrote, parties do not write books to combat each other's opinions, but pamphlets, which are circulated for a day with incredible rapidity and then expire. And he referred to both newspapers and pamphlets when he observed, the invention of firearms equalized the vassal and the noble on the field of battle. The art of printing opened the same resources to the minds of all classes. The post brought knowledge alike to the door of the cottage and to the gate of the palace. At the time Tocqueville was making his observations of America, printing had already spread to all the regions of the country. The South had lagged behind the North not only in the formation of schools, almost all of which were private rather than public, but in its uses of the printing press. Virginia, for example, did not get its first regularly published newspaper, the Virginia Gazette, until 1736. But toward the end of the 18th century, the movement of ideas via the printed word was relatively rapid, and something approximating a national conversation emerged. For example, the Federalist Papers, an outpouring of 85 essays written by Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay, all under the name of Publius, originally appeared in a New York newspaper during 1787 and 1788, but were read almost as widely in the South as the North. As America moved into the 19th century, it did so as a fully print-based culture in all of its regions. Between 1825 and 1850, the number of subscription libraries trebled. What were called mechanics and apprentices libraries, that is, libraries intended for the working class, also emerged as a force for literacy. In 1829, the New York Apprentices Library housed 10,000 volumes, of which 1,600 apprentices drew books. By 1857, the same library served 750,000 people. Aided by Congress's lowering of the postal rates in 1851, the penny newspaper, the periodical, the Sunday school tract, and the cheaply bound book were abundantly available. Between 1836 and 1890, 107 million copies of the McGuffey Reader were distributed to the schools, and although the reading of novels was not considered an altogether reputable use of time, Americans devoured them. Of Walter Scott's novels, published between 1814 and 1832, Samuel Goodrich wrote, "The appearance of a new novel from his pen caused a greater sensation in the United States than did some of the battles of Napoleon. Everybody read these works, everybody, the refined and the simple." Publishers were so anxious to make prospective bestsellers available, they would sometimes dispatch messengers to incoming packet boats and within a single day set up, printed, and bound in paper covers the most recent novel of Bulwer or Dickens. There being no international copyright laws, pirated editions abounded with no complaint from the public or much from authors who were lionized. When Charles Dickens visited America in 1842, his reception equaled the adulation we offer today to television stars, quarterbacks, and Michael Jackson. "I can give you no conception of my welcome," Dickens wrote to a friend. "There never was a king or emperor upon earth so cheered and followed by the crowds and entertained at splendid balls and dinners and waited upon by public bodies of all kinds. If I go out in a carriage, the crowd surrounds it and escorts me home. If I go to the theater, the whole house rises as one man and the timbers ring again." A native daughter, Harriet Beecher Stowe, was not offered the same kind of adoring attention, and, of course, in the South, had her carriage been surrounded, it would not have been for the purpose of escorting her home, but her Uncle Tom's Cabin sold 305,000 copies in its first year, the equivalent of 4 million in today's America. Alexis de Tocqueville was not the only foreign visitor to be impressed by the Americans' immersion in printed matter. During the 19th century, scores of Englishmen came to America to see for themselves what had become of the colonies. All were impressed with the high level of literacy, and in particular, its extension to all classes. In addition, they were astounded by the near universality of lecture halls, in which stylized oral performance provided a continuous reinforcement of the print tradition. Many of these lecture halls originated as a result of the Lyceum movement, a form of adult education. Usually associated with the efforts of Josiah Holbrook, a New England farmer, the Lyceum movement had as its purpose the diffusion of knowledge, the promotion of common schools, the creation of libraries, and especially the establishment of lecture halls. By 1835, there were more than 3,000 lyceums in 15 states. Most of these were located east of the Alleghenies, but by 1840 they were to be found at the edges of the frontier, as far west as Iowa and Minnesota. Alfred Bunn, an Englishman on an extensive tour through America, reported in 1853 that practically every village had its lecture hall. He added, "It is a matter of wonderment to witness the youthful workman, the overtired artisan, the worn-out factory girl, rushing after the toil of the day is over into the hot atmosphere of a crowded lecture room." Bunn's countryman, J.F.W. Johnston, attended lectures at this time at the Smithsonian Institution and found the lecture halls jammed with capacity audiences of 1,200 and 1,500 people. Among the lecturers these audiences could hear were the leading intellectuals, writers, and humorists who were also writers of their time, including Henry Ward Beecher, Horace Greeley, Louis Agassiz, and Ralph Waldo Emerson, whose fee for a lecture was $50. In his autobiography, Mark Twain devotes two chapters to his experiences as a lecturer on the Lyceum circuit. "I began as a lecturer in 1866 in California and Nevada," he wrote. "I lectured in New York once and in the Mississippi Valley a few times. In 1868, I made the whole Western circuit, and in the two or three following seasons added the Eastern circuit to my route." Apparently, Emerson was underpaid, since Twain remarks that some lecturers charged as much as $250 when they spoke in towns and $400 when they spoke in cities, which is almost as much, in today's terms, as the going price for a lecture by a retired television newscaster. The point all of this is leading to is that from its beginning until well into the 19th century, America was as dominated by the printed word and an oratory based on the printed word as any society we know of. This situation was only in part a legacy of the Protestant tradition. As Richard Hofstadter reminds us, America was founded by intellectuals, a rare occurrence in the history of modern nations. "The founding fathers," he writes, "were sages, scientists, men of broad cultivation, many of them apt in classical learning, who used their wide reading in history, politics, and law to solve the exigent problems of their time. A society shaped by such men does not easily move in contrary directions. We might even say that America was founded by intellectuals, from which it has taken us two centuries and a communications revolution to recover." Hofstadter has written convincingly of our efforts to recover, that is to say, of the anti-intellectual strain in American public life, but he concedes that his focus distorts the general picture. It is akin to writing a history of American business by concentrating on the history of bankruptcies. The influence of the printed word in every arena of public discourse was insistent and powerful, not merely because of the quantity of printed matter, but because of its monopoly. This point cannot be stressed enough, especially for those who are reluctant to acknowledge profound differences in the media environments of then and now. One sometimes hears it said, for example, that there is more printed matter available today than ever before, which is undoubtedly true. But from the 17th century to the late 19th century, printed matter was virtually all that was available. There were no movies to see, radio to hear, photographic displays to look at, records to play. There was no television. Public business was channeled into and expressed through print, which became the model, the metaphor, and the measure of all discourse. The resonances of the lineal analytical structure of print, and in particular of expository prose, could be felt everywhere. For example, in how people talked. Tocqueville remarks on this in Democracy in America. An American, he wrote, cannot converse, but he can discuss, and his talk falls into a dissertation. He speaks to you as if he was addressing a meeting, and if he should chance to become warm in the discussion, he will say, "Gentlemen," to the person with whom he is conversing. This odd practice is less a reflection of an American's obstinacy than of his modeling his conversational style on the structure of the printed word. Since the printed word is impersonal and is addressed to an invisible audience, what Tocqueville is describing here is a kind of printed orality, which was observable in diverse forms of oral discourse. On the pulpit, for example, sermons were usually written speeches delivered in a stately, impersonal tone consisting largely of an impassioned, coldly analytical cataloging of the attributes of the deity as revealed to man through nature and nature's laws. And even when the Great Awakening came, a revivalist movement that challenged the analytical, dispassionate spirit of deism, its highly emotional preachers used an oratory that could be transformed easily to the printed page. The most charismatic of these men was the Reverend George Whitefield, who, beginning in 1739, preached all over America to large crowds. In Philadelphia, he addressed an audience of 10,000 people, whom he deeply stirred and alarmed by assuring them of eternal hellfire if they refused to accept Christ. Benjamin Franklin witnessed one of Whitefield's performances and responded by offering to become his publisher. In due time, Whitefield's journals and sermons were published by B. Franklin of Philadelphia. But obviously, I do not mean to say that print merely influenced the form of public discourse. That does not say much unless one connects it to the more important idea that form will determine the nature of content. For those readers who may believe that this idea is too McLuhan-esque for their taste, I offer Karl Marx from The German Ideology. Is the Iliad possible, he asks rhetorically, when the printing press and even printing machines exist? Is it not inevitable that with the emergence of the press, the singing and the telling and the muse cease? That is, the conditions necessary for epic poetry disappear? Marx understood well that the press was not merely a machine but a structure for discourse, which both rules out and insists upon certain kinds of content and, inevitably, a certain kind of audience. He did not himself fully explore the matter, and others have taken up the task. I, too, must try my hand at it, to explore how the press worked as a metaphor and an epistemology to create a serious and rational public conversation from which we have now been so dramatically separated. Chapter 4. The Typographic Mind. The first of the seven famous debates between Abraham Lincoln and Stephen A. Douglas took place on August 21, 1858, in Ottawa, Illinois. Their arrangement provided that Douglas would speak first, for 1 hour. Lincoln would take an hour and a half to reply. Douglas a half hour to rebut Lincoln's reply. This debate was considerably shorter than those to which the two men were accustomed. In fact, they had tangled several times before, and all of their encounters had been much lengthier and more exhausting. For example, on October 16, 1854, in Peoria, Illinois, Douglas delivered a 3-hour address, to which Lincoln, by agreement, was to respond. When Lincoln's turn came, he reminded the audience that it was already 5 p.m., that he would probably require as much time as Douglas, and that Douglas was still scheduled for a rebuttal. He proposed, therefore, that the audience go home, have dinner, and return refreshed for 4 more hours of talk. The audience amiably agreed, and matters proceeded as Lincoln had outlined. What kind of audience was this? Who were these people who could so cheerfully accommodate themselves to 7 hours of oratory? It should be noted, by the way, that Lincoln and Douglas were not presidential candidates. At the time of their encounter in Peoria, they were not even candidates for the United States Senate. But their audiences were not especially concerned with their official status. These were people who regarded such events as essential to their political education, who took them to be an integral part of their social lives, and who were quite accustomed to extended oratorical performances. Typically, at county or state fairs, programs included many speakers, most of whom were allotted 3 hours for their arguments. And since it was preferred that speakers not go unanswered, their opponents were allotted an equal length of time. One might add that the speakers were not always men. At one fair lasting several days in Springfield, each evening a woman lectured in the courtroom on women's influence in the great progressive movements of the day. Moreover, these people did not rely on fairs or special events to get their fill of oratory. The tradition of the stump speaker was widely practiced, especially in the Western states. By the stump of a felled tree or some equivalent open space, a speaker would gather an audience and, as the saying had it, take the stump for 2 or 3 hours. Although audiences were mostly respectful and attentive, they were not quiet or unemotional. Throughout the Lincoln-Douglas debates, for example, people shouted encouragement to the speakers, "You tell 'em, Abe," or voiced terse expressions of scorn, "Answer that one if you can." Applause was frequent, usually reserved for a humorous or elegant phrase or a cogent point. At the first debate in Ottawa, Douglas responded to lengthy applause with a remarkable and revealing statement. "My friends," he said, "silence will be more acceptable to me in the discussion of these questions than applause. I desire to address myself to your judgment, your understanding, and your consciences, and not to your passions or your enthusiasms." As to the conscience of the audience, or even its judgment, it is difficult to say very much, but as to its understanding, a great deal can be assumed. For one thing, its attention span would obviously have been extraordinary by current standards. Is there any audience of Americans today who could endure 7 hours of talk, or 5, or 3, especially without pictures of any kind? Second, these audiences must have had an equally extraordinary capacity to comprehend lengthy and complex sentences orally. In Douglas's Ottawa speech, he included in his one-hour address 3 long, legally phrased resolutions of the abolition platform. Lincoln, in his reply, read even longer passages from a published speech he had delivered on a previous occasion. For all of Lincoln's celebrated economy of style, his sentence structure in the debates was intricate and subtle, as was Douglas's. In the second debate at Freeport, Illinois, Lincoln rose to answer Douglas in the following words, "It will readily occur to you that I cannot, in half an hour, notice all the things that so able a man as Judge Douglas can say in an hour and a half, and I hope, therefore, if there be anything that he has said upon which you would like to hear something from me, but which I omit to comment upon, you will bear in mind that it would be expecting an impossibility for me to cover his whole ground." It is hard to imagine the present occupant of the White House being capable of constructing such clauses in similar circumstances, and if he were, he would surely do so at the risk of burdening the comprehension or concentration of his audience. People of a television culture need plain language, both orally and visually, and will even go so far as to require it in some circumstances by law. The Gettysburg Address would probably have been largely incomprehensible to a 1985 audience. The Lincoln-Douglas audience apparently had a considerable grasp of the issues being debated, including knowledge of historical events and complex political matters. At Ottawa, Douglas put 7 interrogatives to Lincoln, all of which would have been rhetorically pointless unless the audience was familiar with the Dred Scott decision, the quarrel between Douglas and President Buchanan, the disaffection of some Democrats, the abolition platform, and Lincoln's famous House Divided speech at Cooper Union. Further, in answering Douglas's questions in a later debate, Lincoln made a subtle distinction between what he was or was not pledged to uphold and what he actually believed, which he surely would not have attempted unless he assumed the audience could grasp his point. Finally, while both speakers employed some of the more simple-minded weapons of argumentative language, for example, name-calling and bombastic generalities, they consistently drew upon more complex rhetorical resources: sarcasm, irony, paradox, elaborated metaphors, fine distinctions, and the exposure of contradiction, none of which would have advanced their respective causes unless the audience was fully aware of the means being employed. It would be false, however, to give the impression that these 1858 audiences were models of intellectual propriety. All of the Lincoln-Douglas debates were conducted amid a carnival-like atmosphere. Bands played, although not during the debates. Hawkers sold their wares, children romped, liquor was available. These were important social events as well as rhetorical performances, but this did not trivialize them. As I have indicated, these audiences were made up of people whose intellectual lives and public business were fully integrated into their social world. As Winthrop Hudson has pointed out, even Methodist camp meetings combined picnics with opportunities to listen to oratory. Indeed, most of the campgrounds originally established for religious inspiration, Chautauqua, New York, Ocean Grove, New Jersey, Bayview, Michigan, Junaluska, North Carolina, were eventually transformed into conference centers, serving educational and intellectual functions. In other words, the use of language as a means of complex argument was an important, pleasurable, and common form of discourse in almost every public arena. To understand the audience to whom Lincoln and Douglas directed their memorable language, we must remember that these people were the grandsons and granddaughters of the Enlightenment, American version. They were the progeny of Franklin, Jefferson, Madison, and Tom Paine, the inheritors of the Empire of Reason, as Henry Steele Commager has called 18th-century America. It is true that among their number were frontiersmen, some of whom were barely literate, and immigrants to whom English was still strange. It is also true that by 1858 the photograph and telegraph had been invented, the advance guard of a new epistemology that would put an end to the Empire of Reason. But this would not become evident until the 20th century. At the time of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, America was in the middle years of its most glorious literary outpouring. In 1858, Edwin Markham was 6 years old, Mark Twain was 23, Emily Dickinson 28, Whitman and James Russell Lowell 39, Thoreau 41, Melville 45, Whittier and Longfellow 51, Hawthorne and Emerson 54 and 55. Poe had died 9 years before. I choose the Lincoln-Douglas debates as a starting point for this chapter, not only because they were the preeminent example of political discourse in the mid-19th century, but also because they illustrate the power of typography to control the character of that discourse. Both the speakers and their audience were habituated to a kind of oratory that may be described as literary. For all of the hoopla and socializing surrounding the event, the speakers had little to offer, and audiences little to expect, but language. And the language that was offered was clearly modeled on the style of the written word. To anyone who has read what Lincoln and Douglas said, this is obvious from beginning to end. The debates opened, in fact, with Douglas making the following introduction, highly characteristic of everything that was said afterward. "Ladies and gentlemen, I appear before you today for the purpose of discussing the leading political topics which now agitate the public mind. By an arrangement between Mr. Lincoln and myself, we are present here today for the purpose of having a joint discussion, as the representatives of the two great political parties of the State and Union, upon the principles in issue between those parties, and this vast concourse of people shows the deep feeling which pervades the public mind in regard to the questions dividing us." This language is pure print. That the occasion required it to be spoken aloud cannot obscure that fact. And that the audience was able to process it through the ear is remarkable only to people whose culture no longer resonates powerfully with the printed word. Not only did Lincoln and Douglas write all their speeches in advance, but they also planned their rebuttals in writing. Even the spontaneous interactions between the speakers were expressed in a sentence structure, sentence length, and rhetorical organization which took their form from writing. To be sure, there were elements of pure orality in their presentations. After all, neither speaker was indifferent to the moods of the audiences. Nonetheless, the resonance of typography was ever present. Here was argument and counter-argument, claim and counterclaim, criticism of relevant texts, the most careful scrutiny of the previously uttered sentences of one's opponent. In short, the Lincoln-Douglas debates may be described as expository prose lifted whole from the printed page. That is the meaning of Douglas' reproach to the audience. He claimed that his appeal was to understanding and not to passion, as if the audience were to be silent, reflective readers, and his language the text which they must ponder. Which brings us, of course, to the questions. What are the implications for public discourse of a written or typographic metaphor? What is the character of its content? What does it demand of the public? What uses of the mind does it favor? One must begin, I think, by pointing to the obvious fact that the written word and an oratory based upon it has a content. A semantic, paraphrasable, propositional content. This may sound odd, but since I shall be arguing soon enough that much of our discourse today has only a marginal propositional content, I must stress the point here. Whenever language is the principal medium of communication, especially language controlled by the rigors of print, an idea, a fact, a claim is the inevitable result. The idea may be banal, the fact irrelevant, the claim false, but there is no escape from meaning when language is the instrument guiding one's thought. Though one may accomplish it from time to time, it is very hard to say nothing when employing a written English sentence. What else is exposition good for? Words have very little to recommend them except as carriers of meaning. The shapes of written words are not especially interesting to look at. Even the sounds of sentences of spoken words are rarely engaging except when composed by those with extraordinary poetic gifts. If a sentence refuses to issue forth a fact, a request, a question, an assertion, an explanation, it is nonsense, a mere grammatical shell. As a consequence, a language-centered discourse, such as was characteristic of 18th and 19th century America, tends to be both content-laden and serious, all the more so when it takes its form from print. It is serious because meaning demands to be understood. A written sentence calls upon its author to say something, upon its reader to know the import of what is said. And when an author and reader are struggling with semantic meaning, they are engaged in the most serious challenge to the intellect. This is especially the case with the act of reading, for authors are not always trustworthy. They lie, they become confused, they overgeneralize, they abuse logic, and sometimes common sense. The reader must come armed, in a serious state of intellectual readiness. This is not easy because he comes to the text alone. In reading, one's responses are isolated, one's intellect thrown back on its own resources. To be confronted by the cold abstractions of printed sentences is to look upon language bare, without the assistance of either beauty or community. Thus, reading is by its nature a serious business. It is also, of course, an essentially rational activity. From Erasmus in the 16th century to Elizabeth Eisenstein in the 20th, almost every scholar who has grappled with the question of what reading does to one's habits of mind has concluded that the process encourages rationality, that the sequential propositional character of the written word fosters what Walter Ong calls the analytic management of knowledge. To engage the written word means to follow a line of thought, which requires considerable powers of classifying, inference-making, and reasoning. It means to uncover lies, confusions, and overgeneralizations, to detect abuses of logic and common sense. It also means to weigh ideas, to compare and contrast assertions, to connect one generalization to another. To accomplish this, one must achieve a certain distance from the words themselves, which is, in fact, encouraged by the isolated and impersonal text. That is why a good reader does not cheer an apt sentence or pause to applaud even an inspired paragraph. Analytic thought is too busy for that, and too detached. I do not mean to imply that prior to the written word, analytic thought was not possible. I am referring here not to the potentialities of the individual mind, but to the predispositions of a cultural mindset. In a culture dominated by print, public discourse tends to be characterized by a coherent, orderly arrangement of facts and ideas. The public for whom it is intended is generally competent to manage such discourse. In a print culture, writers make mistakes when they lie, contradict themselves, fail to support their generalizations, try to enforce illogical connections. In a print culture, readers make mistakes when they don't notice, or even worse, don't care. In the 18th and 19th centuries, print put forward a definition of intelligence that gave priority to the objective, rational use of the mind, and at the same time encouraged forms of public discourse with serious, logically ordered content. It is no accident that the Age of Reason was coexistent with the growth of a print culture, first in Europe and then in America. The spread of typography kindled the hope that the world and its manifold mysteries could at least be comprehended, predicted, controlled. It is in the 18th century that science, the preeminent example of the analytic management of knowledge, begins its refashioning of the world. It is in the 18th century that capitalism is demonstrated to be a rational and liberal system of economic life, that religious superstition comes under furious attack, that the divine right of kings is shown to be a mere prejudice, that the idea of continuous progress takes hold, and that the necessity of universal literacy through education becomes apparent. Perhaps the most optimistic expression of everything that typography implied is contained in the following paragraph from John Stuart Mill's autobiography. "So complete was my father's reliance on the influence of mankind, wherever literacy is allowed to reach them, that he felt as if all would be gained if the whole population were taught to read, if all sorts of opinions were allowed to be addressed to them by word and in writing, and if, by means of the suffrage, they could nominate a legislature to give effect to the opinion they adopted." This was, of course, a hope never quite realized. At no point in the history of England or America or any place else has the dominion of reason been so total as the elder Mill imagined typography would allow. Nonetheless, it is not difficult to demonstrate that in the 18th and 19th centuries, American public discourse, being rooted in the bias of the printed word, was serious, inclined toward rational argument and presentation, and therefore made up of meaningful content. Let us take religious discourse as an illustration of this point. In the 18th century, believers were as much influenced by the rationalist tradition as anyone else. The New World offered freedom of religion to all, which implied that no force other than reason itself could be employed to bring light to the unbeliever. "Here deism will have its full chance," said Ezra Stiles in one of his famous sermons in 1783, "nor need libertines any more to complain of being overcome by any weapons but the gentle, the powerful ones of argument and truth." Leaving aside the libertines, we know that the deists were certainly given their full chance. It is quite probable, in fact, that the first four presidents of the United States were deists. Jefferson certainly did not believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ, and while he was president, wrote a version of the four Gospels from which he removed all references to fantastic events, retaining only the ethical content of Jesus' teaching. Legend has it that when Jefferson was elected president, old women hid their Bibles and shed tears. What they might have done had Tom Paine become president or been offered some high post in the government is hard to imagine. In the Age of Reason, Paine attacked the Bible and all subsequent Christian theology. Of Jesus Christ, Paine allowed that he was a virtuous and amiable man, but charged that the stories of his divinity were absurd and profane, which, in the way of the rationalist, he tried to prove by a close textual analysis of the Bible. All national institutions of churches, he wrote, whether Jewish, Christian, or Turkish, appear to me no other than human inventions, set up to terrify and enslave mankind and monopolize power and profit. Because of the Age of Reason, Paine lost his standing among the pantheon of founding fathers, and to this day is treated ambiguously in American history textbooks. But Ezra Stiles did not say that libertines and deists would be loved, only that with reason as their jury they would have their say in an open court, as indeed they did. Assisted by the initial enthusiasms evoked by the French Revolution, the deist attack on churches as enemies of progress and on religious superstition as enemy of rationality became a popular movement. The churches fought back, of course, and when deism ceased to attract interest, they fought among themselves. Toward the mid-18th century, Theodore Frelinghuysen and William Tennant led a revivalist movement among Presbyterians. They were followed by the three great figures associated with religious awakenings in America: Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield, and later in the 19th century, Charles Finney. These men were spectacularly successful preachers, whose appeal reached regions of consciousness far beyond where reason rules. Of Whitefield, it was said that by merely pronouncing the word Mesopotamia, he evoked tears in his audience. Perhaps that is why Henry Coswell remarked in 1839 that religious mania is said to be the prevailing form of insanity in the United States. Yet it is essential to bear in mind that quarrels over doctrine between the revivalist movements of the 18th and 19th centuries and the established churches fiercely opposed to them were argued in pamphlets and books in largely rational, logically ordered language. It would be a serious mistake to think of Billy Graham or any other television revivalist as a latter-day Jonathan Edwards or Charles Finney. Edwards was one of the most brilliant and creative minds ever produced by America. His contribution to aesthetic theory was almost as important as his contribution to theology. His interests were mostly academic. He spent long hours each day in his study. He did not speak to his audiences extemporaneously. He read his sermons, which were tightly knit and closely reasoned expositions of theological doctrine. Audiences may have been moved emotionally by Edwards' language, but they were, first and foremost, required to understand it. Indeed, Edwards' fame was largely a result of a book, Faithful Narrative of the Surprising Work of God in the Conversion of Many Hundred Souls in Northampton, published in 1737. A later book, A Treatise Concerning Religious Affections, published in 1746, is considered to be among the most remarkable psychological studies ever produced in America. Unlike the principal figures in today's Great Awakening, Oral Roberts, Jerry Falwell, Jimmy Swaggart, et al., yesterday's leaders of revivalist movements in America were men of learning, faith in reason, and generous expository gifts. Their disputes with the religious establishments were as much about theology and the nature of consciousness as they were about religious inspiration. Finney, for example, was no backcountry rustic as he was sometimes characterized by his doctrinal opponents. He had been trained as a lawyer, wrote an important book on systematic theology, and ended his career as a professor at and then president of Oberlin College. The doctrinal disputes among religionists not only were argued in carefully drawn exposition in the 18th century, but in the 19th century were settled by the extraordinary expedient of founding colleges. It is sometimes forgotten that the churches in America laid the foundation of our system of higher education. Harvard, of course, was established early in 1636 for the purpose of providing learned ministers to the Congregational Church, and 65 years later, when Congregationalists quarreled among themselves over doctrine, Yale College was founded to correct the lax influences of Harvard, and to this day claims it has the same burden. The strong intellectual strain of the Congregationalists was matched by other denominations, certainly in their passion for starting colleges. The Presbyterians founded, among other schools, the University of Tennessee in 1784, Washington and Jefferson in 1802, and Lafayette in 1826. The Baptists founded, among others, Colgate, 1817, George Washington, 1821, Furman, 1826, Denison, 1832, and Wake Forest, 1834. The Episcopalians founded Hobart, 1822, Trinity, 1823, and Kenyon, 1824. The Methodists founded eight colleges between 1830 and 1851, including Wesleyan, Emory, and DePauw. In addition to Harvard and Yale, the Congregationalists founded Williams, 1793, Middlebury, 1800, Amherst, 1821, and Oberlin, 1833. If this preoccupation with literacy and learning be a form of insanity, as Coswell said, of religious life in America, then let there be more of it. In the 18th and 19th centuries, religious thought and institutions in America were dominated by an austere, learned, and intellectual form of discourse that is largely absent from religious life today. No clearer example of the difference between earlier and modern forms of public discourse can be found than in the contrast between the theological arguments of Jonathan Edwards and those of, say, Jerry Falwell or Billy Graham or Oral Roberts. The formidable content to Edwards' theology must inevitably engage the intellect. If there is such a content to the theology of the television evangelicals, they have not yet made it known. The differences between the character of discourse in a print-based culture and the character of discourse in a television-based culture are also evident if one looks at the legal system. In a print-based culture, lawyers tended to be well-educated, devoted to reason, and capable of impressive expositional argument. It is a matter frequently overlooked in histories of America that in the 18th and 19th centuries, the legal profession represented a sort of privileged body in the scale of intellect, as Tocqueville remarked. Folk heroes were made of some of those lawyers, like Sergeant Prentice of Alabama or Honest Abe Lincoln of Illinois, whose craftiness in manipulating juries was highly theatrical, not unlike television's version of a trial lawyer. But the great figures of American jurisprudence, John Marshall, Joseph Story, James Kent, David Hoffman, William Wirt, and Daniel Webster, were models of intellectual elegance and devotion to rationality and scholarship. They believed that democracy, for all of its obvious virtues, posed the danger of releasing an undisciplined individualism. Their aspiration was to save civilization in America by creating a rationality for the law. As a consequence of this exalted view, they believed that law must not be merely a learned profession, but a liberal one. The famous law professor Job Tyson argued that a lawyer must be familiar with the works of Seneca, Cicero, and Plato. George Sharswood, perhaps envisioning the degraded state of legal education in the 20th century, remarked in 1854 that to read law exclusively will damage the mind, shackle it to the technicalities with which it has become so familiar, and disable it from taking enlarged and comprehensive views even of topics falling within its compass. The insistence on a liberal, rational, and articulate legal mind was reinforced by the fact that America had a written constitution, as did all of its component states, and that law did not grow by chance but was explicitly formulated. A lawyer needed to be a writing and reading man par excellence, for reason was the principal authority upon which legal questions were to be decided. John Marshall was, of course, the great paragon of reason, as vivid a symbol to the American imagination as Natty Bumppo. He was the preeminent example of typographic man, detached, analytical, devoted to logic, abhorring contradiction. It was said of him that he never used analogy as a principal support of his arguments. Rather, he introduced most of his decisions with the phrase, "It is admitted." Once one admitted his premises, one was usually forced to accept his conclusion. To an extent difficult to imagine today, earlier Americans were familiar not only with the great legal issues of their time, but even with the language famous lawyers had used to argue their cases. This was especially true of Daniel Webster, and it was only natural that Stephen Vincent Benet, in his famous short story, would have chosen Daniel Webster to contend with the devil. How could the devil triumph over a man whose language, described by Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story, had the following characteristics? His clearness and downright simplicity of statement, his vast comprehensiveness of topics, his fertility in illustrations drawn from practical sources, his keen analysis and suggestion of difficulties, his power of disentangling a complicated proposition and resolving it in elements so plain as to reach the most common minds, his vigor in generalizations, planting his own arguments behind the whole battery of his opponents, his wariness and caution not to betray himself by heat into untenable positions or to spread his forces over useless ground. I quote this in full because it is the best 19th century description I know of the character of discourse expected of one whose mind is formed by the printed word. It is exactly the ideal and model James Mill had in mind in prophesying about the wonders of typography. And if the model was somewhat unreachable, it stood nonetheless as an ideal to which every lawyer aspired. Such an ideal went far beyond the legal profession or the ministry and its influence. Even in the everyday world of commerce, the resonances of rational typographic discourse were to be found. If we may take advertising to be the voice of commerce, then its history tells very clearly that in the 18th and 19th centuries, those with products to sell took their customers to be not unlike Daniel Webster. They assumed that potential buyers were literate, rational, analytical, Indeed, the history of newspaper advertising in America may be considered all by itself as a metaphor of the descent of the typographic mind, beginning as it does with reason and ending as it does with entertainment. In Frank Presbrey's classic study, The History and Development of Advertising, he discusses the decline of typography, dating its demise in the late 1860s and early 1870s. He refers to the period before then as the Dark Ages of typographical display. The Dark Ages to which he refers began in 1704, when the first paid advertisements appeared in an American newspaper, the Boston Newsletter. These were three in number, occupying altogether 4 inches of single-column space. One of them offered a reward for the capture of a thief, another offered a reward for the return of an anvil that was taken up by some unknown party. The third actually offered something for sale, and in fact is not unlike real estate advertisements one might see in today's New York Times. At Oyster Bay on Long Island in the province of New York, there is a very good fulling mill to be let or sold, as also a plantation, having on it a large new brick house and another good house by it for a kitchen and workhouse with a barn, stable, and so forth, a young orchard, and 20 acres clear land. The mill is to be let with or without the plantation. Inquire of Mr. William Bradford, printer in New York, and no further. For more than a century and a half afterward, advertisements took this form with minor alterations. For example, 64 years after Mr. Bradford advertised an estate in Oyster Bay, the legendary Paul Revere placed the following advertisement in the Boston Gazette. Whereas many persons are so unfortunate as to lose their foreteeth by accident and other ways to their great detriment, not only in looks, but speaking both in public and private, this is to inform all such that they may have them replaced with false ones that look as well as the natural and answers the end of speaking to all intents, by Paul Revere, goldsmith, near the head of Dr. Clark's Wharf, Boston. Revere went on to explain in another paragraph that those whose false teeth had been fitted by John Baker and who had suffered the indignity of having them loosen might come to Revere to have them tightened. He indicated that he had learned how to do this from John Baker himself. Not until almost 100 years after Revere's announcement were there any serious attempts by advertisers to overcome the lineal typographic form demanded by publishers, and not until the end of the 19th century did advertising move fully into its modern mode of discourse. As late as 1890, advertising, still understood to consist of words, was regarded as an essentially serious and rational enterprise, whose purpose was to convey information and make claims in propositional form. Advertising was, as Stephen Douglas said in another context, intended to appeal to understanding, not to passions. This is not to say that during the period of typographic display the claims that were put forward were true. Words cannot guarantee their truth content. Rather, they assemble a context in which the question, "Is this true or false?" is relevant. In the 1890s, that context was shattered, first by the massive intrusion of illustrations and photographs, then by the non-propositional use of language. For example, in the 1890s, advertisers adopted the technique of using slogans. Presbrey contends that modern advertising can be said to begin with the use of two such slogans, "You press the button, we do the rest," and "See that hump?" At about the same time, jingles started to be used, and in 1892, Procter & Gamble invited the public to submit rhymes to advertise Ivory soap. In 1896, H.O. employed, for the first time, a picture of a baby in a high chair, the bowl of cereal before him, his spoon in hand, his face ecstatic. By the turn of the century, advertisers no longer assumed rationality on the part of their potential customers. Advertising became one part depth psychology, one part aesthetic theory. Reason had to move itself to other arenas. To understand the role that the printed word played in providing an earlier America with its assumptions about intelligence, truth, and the nature of discourse, one must keep in view that the act of reading in the 18th and 19th centuries had an entirely different quality to it than the act of reading does today. For one thing, as I have said, the printed word had a monopoly on both attention and intellect, there being no other means, besides the oral tradition, to have access to public knowledge. Public figures were known largely by their written words, for example, not by their looks or even their oratory. It is quite likely that most of the first 15 presidents of the United States would not have been recognized had they passed the average citizen in the street. This would have been the case as well of the great lawyers, ministers, and scientists of that era. To think about those men was to think about what they had written, to judge them by their public positions, their arguments, their knowledge as codified in the printed word. You may get some sense of how we are separated from this kind of consciousness by thinking about any of our recent presidents or even preachers, lawyers, and scientists who are or who have recently been public figures. Think of Richard Nixon or Jimmy Carter or Billy Graham or even Albert Einstein, and what will come to your mind is an image, a picture of a face, most likely a face on a television screen, in Einstein's case, a photograph of a face. Of words, almost nothing will come to mind. This is the difference between thinking in a word-centered culture and thinking in an image-centered culture. It is also the difference between living in a culture that provides little opportunity for leisure and one that provides much. The farm boy following the plow with book in hand, the mother reading aloud to her family on a Sunday afternoon, the merchant reading announcements of the latest clipper arrivals, these were different kinds of readers from those of today. There would have been little casual reading, for there was not a great deal of time for that. Reading would have had a sacred element in it, or if not that, would have at least occurred as a daily or weekly ritual invested with special meaning. For we must also remember that this was a culture without electricity. It would not have been easy to read by either candlelight or, later, gaslight. Doubtless, much reading was done between dawn and the start of the day's business. What reading would have been done was done seriously, intensely, and with steadfast purpose. The modern idea of testing a reader's comprehension as distinct from something else a reader may be doing would have seemed an absurdity in 1790 or 1830 or 1860. What else was reading but comprehending? As far as we know, there did not exist such a thing as a reading problem, except, of course, for those who could not attend school. To attend school meant to learn to read, for without that capacity, one could not participate in the culture's conversations. But most people could read and did participate. To these people, reading was both their connection to and their model of the world. The printed page revealed the world, line by line, page by page, to be a serious, coherent place, capable of management by reason and of improvement by logical and relevant criticism. Almost anywhere one looks in the 18th and 19th centuries, then, one finds the resonances of the printed word, and in particular its inextricable relationship to all forms of public expression. It may be true, as Charles Beard wrote, that the primary motivation of the writers of the United States Constitution was the protection of their economic interests, but it is also true that they assumed that participation in public life required the capacity to negotiate the printed word. To them, mature citizenship was not conceivable without sophisticated literacy, which is why the voting age in most states was set at 21, and why Jefferson saw in universal education America's best hope. And that is also why, as Allen Nevins and Henry Steele Commager have pointed out, the voting restrictions against those who owned no property were frequently overlooked, but not one's inability to read. It may be true, as Frederick Jackson Turner wrote, that the spirit that fired the American mind was the fact of an ever-expanding frontier, but it is also true, as Paul Anderson has written, that it is no mere figure of speech to say that farm boys followed the plow with book in hand, be it Shakespeare, Emerson, or Thoreau. For it was not only a frontier mentality that led Kansas to be the first state to permit women to vote in school elections, or Wyoming the first state to grant complete equality in the franchise. Women were probably more adept readers than men, and even in the frontier states, the principal means of public discourse issued from the printed word. Those who could read had, inevitably, to become part of the conversation. It may also be true, as Perry Miller has suggested, that the religious fervor of Americans provided much of their energy, or, as earlier historians told it, that America was created by an idea whose time had come. I quarrel with none of these explanations. I merely observe that the America they try to explain was dominated by a public discourse which took its form from the products of the printing press. For two centuries, America declared its intentions, expressed its ideology, designed its laws, sold its products, created its literature, and addressed its deities with black squiggles on white paper. It did its talking in typography, and with that as the main feature of its symbolic environment, rose to prominence in world civilization. The name I give to that period of time during which the American mind submitted itself to the sovereignty of the printing press is the Age of Exposition. Exposition is a mode of thought, a method of learning, and a means of expression. Almost all of the characteristics we associate with mature discourse were amplified by typography, which has the strongest possible bias toward exposition, a sophisticated ability to think conceptually, deductively, and sequentially, a high valuation of reason and order, an abhorrence of contradiction, a large capacity for detachment and objectivity, and a tolerance for delayed response. Toward the end of the 19th century, for reasons I am most anxious to explain, the Age of Exposition began to pass, and the early signs of its replacement could be discerned. Its replacement was to be the Age of Show Business. Chapter 5. The Peekaboo World. Toward the middle years of the 19th century, two ideas came together whose convergence provided 20th century America with a new metaphor of public discourse. Their partnership overwhelmed the age of exposition and laid the foundation for the age of show business. One of the ideas was quite new, the other as old as the cave paintings of Altamira. We shall come to the old idea presently. The new idea was that transportation and communication could be disengaged from each other, that space was not an inevitable constraint on the movement of information. Americans of the 1800s were very much concerned with the problem of conquering space. By the mid-19th century, the frontier extended to the Pacific Ocean, and a rudimentary railroad system begun in the 1830s had started to move people and merchandise across the continent. But until the 1840s, information could move only as fast as a human being could carry it. To be precise, only as fast as a train could travel, which, to be even more precise, meant about 35 miles per hour. In the face of such a limitation, the development of America as a national community was retarded. In the 1840s, America was still a composite of regions, each conversing in its own ways, addressing its own interests. A continent-wide conversation was not yet possible. The solution to these problems, as every schoolchild used to know, was electricity. To no one's surprise, it was an American who found a practical way to put electricity in the service of communication, and in doing so eliminated the problem of space once and for all. I refer, of course, to Samuel Finley Breese Morse, America's first true spaceman. His telegraph erased state lines, collapsed regions, and, by wrapping the continent in an information grid, created the possibility of a unified American discourse. But at a considerable cost. For telegraphy did something that Morse did not foresee when he prophesied that telegraphy would make one neighborhood of the whole country. It destroyed the prevailing definition of information, and in doing so gave a new meaning to public discourse. Among the few who understood this consequence was Henry David Thoreau, who remarked in Walden that we are in great haste to construct a magnetic telegraph from Maine to Texas, but Maine and Texas, it may be, have nothing important to communicate. We are eager to tunnel under the Atlantic and bring the old world some weeks nearer to the new, but perchance the first news that will leak through into the broad, flapping American ear will be that Princess Adelaide has the whooping cough. Thoreau, as it turned out, was precisely correct. He grasped that the telegraph would create its own definition of discourse, that it would not only permit but insist upon a conversation between Maine and Texas, and that it would require the content of that conversation to be different from what typographic man was accustomed to. The telegraph made a three-pronged attack on typography's definition of discourse, introducing on a large scale irrelevance, impotence, and incoherence. These demons of discourse were aroused by the fact that telegraphy gave a form of legitimacy to the idea of context-free information, that is, to the idea that the value of information need not be tied to any function it might serve in social and political decision-making and action, but may attach merely to its novelty, interest, and curiosity. The telegraph made information into a commodity, a thing that could be bought and sold irrespective of its uses or meaning. But it did not do so alone. The potential of the telegraph to transform information into a commodity might never have been realized except for the partnership between the telegraph and the press. The penny newspaper, emerging slightly before telegraphy in the 1830s, had already begun the process of elevating irrelevance to the status of news. Such papers as Benjamin Day's New York Sun and James Bennett's New York Herald turned away from the tradition of news as reasoned, if biased, political opinion and urgent commercial information and filled their pages with accounts of sensational events, mostly concerning crime and sex. While such human interest news played little role in shaping the decisions and actions of readers, it was at least local, about places and people within their experience, and it was not always tied to the moment. The human interest stories of the penny newspapers had a timeless quality. Their power to engage lay not so much in their currency as in their transcendence. Nor did all newspapers occupy themselves with such content. For the most part, the information they provided was not only local but largely functional, tied to the problems and decisions readers had to address in order to manage their personal and community affairs. The telegraph changed all that, and with astonishing speed. Within months of Morse's first public demonstration, the local and the timeless had lost their central position in newspapers, eclipsed by the dazzle of distance and speed. In fact, the first known use of the telegraph by a newspaper occurred one day after Morse gave his historic demonstration of telegraphy's workability. Using the same Washington to Baltimore line Morse had constructed, the Baltimore Patriot gave its readers information about action taken by the House of Representatives on the Oregon issue. The paper concluded its report by noting, "We are thus enabled to give our readers information from Washington up to 2 o'clock. This is indeed the annihilation of space." For a brief time, practical problems, mostly involving the scarcity of telegraph lines, preserved something of the old definition of news as functional information. But the foresighted among the nation's publishers were quick to see where the future lay and committed their full resources to the wiring of the continent. William Swain, the owner of the Philadelphia Public Ledger, not only invested heavily in the Magnetic Telegraph Company, the first commercial telegraph corporation, but became its president in 1850. It was not long until the fortunes of newspapers came to depend not on the quality or utility of the news they provided, but on how much, from what distances, and at what speed. James Bennett of the New York Herald boasted that in the first week of 1848, his paper contained 79,000 words of telegraphic content,